This episode is sponsored by Team Builder, yet another company that's doing great things for the first responder community. As a strength and conditioning coach myself, who also trains tactical athletes, dissemination of wellness information is one of the biggest challenges. Now, Team Builder is the premier strength and conditioning software for tactical athletes, and there are several features that really impressed me. Firstly, there is a full exercise library, so you, the personal trainer, does not have to create that within your own department. Secondly, you can send out programming, but also individualize, which I love. So you blanket program for everyone. Now you can tweak based on someone's injury, someone's need to maybe drop some body composition, rather than having to write a program for every single person on their own. Team Builder also allows you to build custom questionnaires to collate health and wellness data. It integrates with wearables. And I think one of the most important things is obviously it tracks. To me, it's imperative that we as a profession start tracking our people from day one and then over the full span of their career, therefore catching potential wellness issues and injuries before they happen. Now, if you want to try Team Builder, they are offering you, the audience of the Behind the Shield podcast, a free 14-day trial to experience all of the features. And if you want to take a deeper dive into Team Builder, listen to episode 1032 with Melissa Mercado, or go to teambuilder.com. And I'll spell that to you because it's not as you'd think, teambuildr.com. Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name is James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome back onto the show for the third time, firefighter turned lawyer, Mike Cleland. Now, in this third conversation, Mike wanted to go over all the changes in workman's comp laws when it comes to heart and lung presumption, cancer presumption, PTSD presumption, not to mention topics like fitness standards in the fire service and the 24/72 work week. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single 5-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of almost 1,100 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I welcome back onto the show, Mike Cleland. Enjoy. Well, Mike, I want to start by saying thank you for coming back again. The first two interviews I think we did in your office, and now we're sitting here in my home in Ocala. So I just want to start by welcoming you to the Behind the Shield podcast for the third time.
Great. Glad to be back. Thank you for having me.
So the first time we spoke, we talked to kind of about your background a little bit. The second time you were with one of your colleagues, and we talked about the mental health app that they were developing at the time. Now we're going to take a deep dive back into 2025 and then how we're doing with the heart and lung bill and cancer bill and PTSD bill and some other initiatives that you've got. Before we start, for people that haven't listened to the first or second, let's kind of start at the beginning and give an overview of your journey, you know, where you kind of grew up and then your journey into the fire service.
Sure. I've been in Central Florida, Orlando area since 1974 when I was just a child. When I was in high school, I was a much bigger guy. I was about 6'4", 265, and I wanted to go to college and play football. That was my goal in life. And that was upended when I had a terrible knee injury in my senior year, and they carried me off the field while all the scouts were lined up against the fence. So that was out. My brother, Steve, who's a year and a half older than me, was in the fire service at the time, and convinced me that when my knee got better to try the fire service. And I I never dreamed of being a firefighter, never have a thought of it like most kids do. It just happened. And so I gave it a shot. In fact, I started in fire standards when I was a senior in high school, about to graduate. So when I graduated high school at age 17, Chief Chapman, City of Longwood, small city outside of Orlando, hired me on. I was riding tailboard at the time. And the rest is history. I spent 26 years in the fire service. I was a big union advocate for my department. We organized in 1986. I retired in 07 as a battalion chief outside the bargaining unit. So I've seen both sides of the union management spectrum. I can appreciate both sides, but I'm a staunch union advocate, as was my brother. He served a total of 30 years, ended up at the City of Orlando. But, you know, at the end of my career, I knew that when I was going to be retiring at 25, 26 years, I needed to get out. And that's in part because of, you know, years of pulling kids out of pools and cutting them out of cars and dealing with lots of different types of things that firefighters are faced with. I was 43 at the time. I knew I had to do something else. It was just time. I didn't want to see any more bad shit. And I thought, you know, what can I do at the age 43 with a pension from the FRS, which I appreciate very much today, but I knew I couldn't do this job anymore. So I was at UCF at the time getting my undergraduate degree in political science, and somebody convinced me, why don't you try law school? One of the lawyers who represent the FPF. And I gave it a shot. I took the LSAT. At the time, in 2002-ish, I was graduating at UCF with my undergrad. I took the LSAT, and it just so happened that FAMU Law School was resurrecting in the city of Orlando. So they had opened their doors. I graduated. I retired. I put my app in. They accepted me, and I went through their four-year program. Finished it up in about 3.5 years while I was still on the job. So when I retired in 07, that's when I took the bar and passed. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to represent firefighters the rest of my life, you know, and so that's what I do today. A funny side note to that, when I was in, I think it was my first year of law school, I was in property or contracts or some really difficult, boring law course. And I thought to myself, I'm 38 years old. What the hell am I doing? What am I doing? People hate lawyers as a rule, you know, and I thought, what can I do so that when I get out of here, people aren't going to look at me like, oh, you're just a lawyer. I vowed to be available. And so anybody who knows me and has hired me to help them, they know they get my cell phone, they can text, they can call, nights, weekends, it doesn't matter. So if there was any redeeming quality of being an attorney, it is that I'm going to make myself available to all my clients. And today, I don't know, what is it, 17 years later, all of my clients are first responders, cops, firefighters, corrections officers.
Beautiful. I want to go all the way back to 18-year-old Mike. When in all these conversations I've had now, it seems like the science really backs up the fact that people probably shouldn't go into this profession till they're 21, kind of like the cops, just from the development of the brain. When you reflect back now at the age that you entered, and let's say that we are fully staffed and people are lining up around the building to be firefighters again, like they were when I first, you know, got hired. So there was that demand, so you wouldn't have to pull from high schools. Do you think that 18 was too young in this journey for you?
It's a fair question. I don't know if it's necessarily that it's age specific, but it's maturity and an understanding of what to expect. Back then, I was immature, as most. I have an 18-year-old son. He's immature. He's a kid. He makes decisions that I still shake my head at. I'm sure that's the way I was back then. But this was a career that was fascinating to me. It was intriguing to me. It was tough. And those were my instincts. I wanted to help. I thought it was a very cool job. But had I been more mature at the age of 20, 21, 22 years old and had learned more about what the job entailed, i.e. seeing some really bad stuff, I probably would have at least tried to prepare myself a little better. I think when you're that age and you see stuff, you're working a trauma code on the middle of the interstate at 2 a.m, or you have someone whose body's burned beyond recognition and you're picking them out of cars. That's really, really shocking. I knock on wood to today, because some of my clients suffer from PTSD, that I made it out after 26 years of seeing a bunch of bad stuff, and am able to cope. I made it out okay, and I represent some folks who didn't and aren't okay. So I don't know if it's age specific, but certainly maturity, and with age comes maturity. So I get your take on maybe it's too young to put kids into this position, but it just happened the way it did, and I got lucky and got out.
It'd be interesting to get your take on this. I have seen a massive correlation between people who really found themselves in the darkest places in our profession and unaddressed childhood trauma. So I was in a house fire when I was 4. Parents had a horrific divorce, had another near-death experience when I was about 12. And so there was a lot of stuff, but woven in just by chance, just by winning the address lottery, I grew up on a farm. So I was around, my dad was a veterinary surgeon, so he was healing, there was animals, there was nature, there was fresh food. I'm one of 5 kids, so the dining room table was always packed, full of laughter and different people cycling through. So all the things that we know help heal people were just organically woven into my childhood. I was extremely fortunate. And so I never got to that darkest of places. Now, don't get me wrong, I had some low lows. You know, there's some things that happened with my son and some other things that, definitely were a struggle, but not to the point of drowning in a bottle, not to the point of sitting there with a pistol. So when I reflect back now and hear about all these different stories, that seems to be one of the biggest common denominators. When people say, well, how come so-and-so is okay? Well, what was that other person's past? When you reflect on your early life, were there some strong healing elements that set you up for success with some of the struggles that you had when you were younger?
You know, I didn't have a good childhood. I have a brother, Steve, I told you about, who was a firefighter 30 years. I lost my sister to ovarian cancer at age 24. My mom and father, my dad died at a very young age, 34, but he was also a bad guy. He was brutal to my mother. And I remember lying in bed at night hearing the screams. And so, but we were too young to do anything. My mom, in effect, escaped with the three of us, my brother and my sister and I, and raised us on her own, worked 2 jobs. She was never around because she worked 8 to 5, came home, showered, and then worked nights. So when I did see her on the weekends, it was short-lived. She was sleeping. She was tired. But my childhood was pretty rough. I was also in a position where I had to become an adult really, really quickly. And I don't know why. I mean, my brother and sister, I just took it on to help raise them and steer them in the right direction. And so I was put into that situation very, very early in life. I think helped me prepare for the rigors of the fire department and anything else that I'd seen. I think I was hardened very, very young, through nobody's fault. It was just the situation that my mom was in. She did the best she could. And then when I was early in the fire department, my sister developed cancer and ultimately passed. So that was really bad. And by then, my brother Steve and I were in the fire service. And then we just spent the rest of my mom's life taking care of her like she did us.
When you reflect back now, what were the things between early life to today that you used to offload some of these stress? Because, I mean, you've touched on many of the bad calls that you've seen. What were the positive coping mechanisms that you leaned into?
You know, I don't know, James. I don't know. I don't know what I don't know that I necessarily did anything or have had any coping mechanism. I mean, I saw a psychologist while I was in law school, just to talk about my childhood traumas. But I saw him for about 6 months. I believe that he helped me. I don't know that it necessarily helped me cope with seeing what I saw over all those years. But maybe it did. But I don't. Some people meditate. Some people do yoga. Some people, you know, seek psychotherapy. Things like that. I tell you what I do do, and that is I've been an avid gym rat. I stay in the gym every day for an hour, and I work out. I'm 61 now, so I'm far from what I used to be, but I make it a point to be in the gym 7 days a week, at least for an hour. If I really dig deep, it's probably that's where I get out my, not frustration, but deal with, you know, I get to disconnect, which is healthy, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's one of mine, hands down.
Yeah. Yeah.
What about transition? You, unlike many people, it's funny, you just met my wife a minute ago and we were talking about her graduating med school and she went into that at 40 years old. So I hope this is inspiring people that are listening, thinking they're too old to turn a page in their book. Absolutely not. But when you transitioned out the fire service, a lot of people struggle with that loss of tribe, that loss of identity or purpose. What was your transition like? Because it's a very, you know, unique one, having another profession that you're kind of entering as you walk out the back door of a firehouse.
Yeah. And by the way, I still get questions from young guys who are retiring, either not without fulfilling their 25 or 30 years, or folks who got in early like I did, and they're transitioning out at a relatively young age. And I always encourage them to go to law school. I do. I mean, a lot of them have undergraduate degrees, so they're set up for that. My transition was seamless simply because when I retired and had my law degree, I thought, what a great idea to represent solely first responders. So I get to stay connected, have conversations every day of my life with firefighters and cops, yet I don't have to go on the call at 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. So I don't know who's looking down on me, but I worked my ass off. There's no question about it. I sacrificed about 10 years of my life for education. I didn't go out. I didn't do all those things that, you know, firefighters do and cops do. I stayed in the books, and, you know, a lot of firefighters have part-time jobs. And so on the 2 days off, they do other work. And I just kept my nose in the books. And it turned out that I guess I made the right decision. I'm super happy in my practice. I feel like I'm 30 years old, but I'm 61. I got another 10 or 15 years left in me. I know it, because I just feel that good about what I do and about who I represent. So it's, my transition was luckily seamless. But I encourage anybody who's getting out of the fire service to definitely find a vocation, whatever it is, to keep you busy.
It seems like service is another piece. I've had so many people, especially from the military, and that, well, I went into finance or went into real estate, and it just didn't work for them because they didn't feel like they were giving back. The moment they found whatever that profession was, and like you said, you got law, but still helping first responders, that seems to be the missing piece. And I always tell people this, you know, what we do in uniform, that's not who you are. Who you are is a kind, compassionate person who's courageously going to possibly sacrifice their health or even their life to protect other people. And one point you put a uniform on. So when you come out the back door, to me, you're the same exact person. You're someone that's brave enough to stand up and keep serving in your community. And so I think hearing people that have found professions, you know, like yourself, like me, even though I never anticipated being behind a microphone as a profession, that's such a healing transition because your mission hasn't changed. You're still helping people.
No, you're right. I mean, you put the uniform on, you're still the same person when you took it off, mm-hmm. when you take it off. I think a lot of guys, firefighters, women and men, when they transition out, let's assume that they're in their 50s or 60s and they're going out into retirement and they plan to do X, Y, and Z. You know, they move to Montana and go fishing and do what retired people do. I get calls all the time from people like that who say, gee, it's just, I need more. Like I was so immersed in it, giving back, serving, all of those adjectives to describe the actual person, that when they go from that to nothing, in terms of that. I don't mean their lives aren't worth anything. They transition into having fun, fishing or hunting and doing those types of things. There is a sense of loss, I think. Mm-hmm. And I get that from them when I speak to them. I speak to firefighters all day long. Transitioning out is a difficult thing. And also, I think it gives firefighters and cops and people who have experienced trauma a lot of time to think, and that can be, you know, not a good thing.
Yeah.
Their minds become preoccupied with what their careers were and what they saw. Sometimes I'll reflect back and then I discard it. It's almost like an OCD. It's a bad thought that you can't, it's an irrational thought that you can't discard. And some people, I speak to people all the time who have that. It's sad. And so, you know, I try to steer them in the right direction.
Absolutely. Well, I want to go, it'd be interesting, your journey into the fire service in the 80s. Walk us through the support or lack thereof for the physical and mental health, and kind of give us a timeline from then to where we are now.
Sure. I graduated high school in 82. I was a volunteer until March of 83 is when I became a full-time firefighter. I served until 2007. In the 80s, we didn't have any mental health, and I would say that transitioned into the early 90s. We didn't have any mental health, at least not that I was aware of, outlet that the department sponsored. And I don't think anybody did at the time. I do remember, though, when I was a lieutenant, which had to have been in the mid to late 90s, CISD, that acronym for Critical Incident Stress Debriefing, became a thing. And all the departments, it was Seminole County, and we were in the middle of it with Altamont, Longwood, and Winter Springs, and Castleberry, and Sanford. I chose to represent our department in that regard. And so I think we went to a course or two or three courses and were certified as the critical incident stress debriefing guy. You know what I mean? The flag bearer for our department. That brought into the fold at the time EAP, the Employee Assistance Program, with our department anyway. Once the CISD teams were established and EAP came in, then the mental health part of the job became important. I think it could have been much more important, become better funded, and we could get doctors on board and things like that. But at the time, I do remember coming back from a few scenes that are really nasty. We sit around the kitchen table, you know, make some coffee and sit around and talk to each other about how we felt. But again, in the 90s, certainly in the 80s and into the 90s, it became a stigma to have the need for help. I think it's still that way today, but not as much. Unfortunately, in my opinion, suicides have just raised the awareness of the need for help tenfold. Unfortunately, it cost all those lives and are costing lives today, as we saw recently from the villages. The law as it relates to PTSD, if I can sort of transition into that,
please,
was really bad in the 70s, 80s, 90s, and even into the 2000s. And under workers' comp, workers' comp provides two things, medical care and wage loss. Well, for what the statute considers mental or nervous injuries, which include PTSD, it only provided medical care. So if you suffered from any kind of trauma at work, then the claim could be filed under workers' comp. And by the way, first responders, especially cops, are very reluctant to even file the claim. But those who do and those who did over those years could only get a counselor. And I'm not demeaning that, but there's no psychiatrist appointment. There's none of that. It's simply some mental health counselor to deal with your problem. And if you were incapable of working, whether it was a week, a month, 6 months, a year, because of that mental or nervous injury or post-traumatic stress, you could not get wage loss, the 66 and two-thirds that workers' compensation pays for a broken leg. So for years and years, I never understood how that made any sense. And I was also in the legislature from 2012 to 2014, so I know what the process is like to get a bill through. It's terribly difficult. Nevertheless, when I was up there, I used to think, why in the hell aren't people, first responders who suffer from post-traumatic stress, given wage loss? If I'm on a roof cutting a hole and I fall through and break my leg and I'm off for 6 months, I'm getting wage loss and medical care. Yet I'm traumatized by what I've witnessed, whether it was cumulative or a mass casualty incident, and I can't work. I can't focus for 6 months. I get medical care, but I don't get any wage loss. These injuries are no less important and in most cases more deadly than an injury by accident, that first scenario I created. So finally, with the help of the FPF and others, and I was a consultant a little bit on that issue, we got a bill passed that now provides for wage loss. However, it only provides wage loss if you fit the criteria. There are enumerated criteria under which you can get wage loss and medical care, and they are witnessing the death of a child or a mass casualty incident and injuries that shock the conscience, whatever that means. So those cases are easily denied, and you have to fight for that wage loss. It was a step forward for sure, James, but it wasn't what we wanted. And to get back in, to knock on the door again in the Florida legislature to address the same issue and increase those benefits, I know by experience it doesn't happen the following session. It's sessions later, years and years later. They don't have the appetite. They feel like they gave so much that to come back and want more, politics becomes involved, and it's nasty.
In your opinion, knowing that, from what I understand, people have told me this, that in the military, in the VA, you can self-report PTSD and you will have access to certain things. And that's obviously growing. And they're in Texas, they're fighting obviously for, you know, ayahuasca and some of these other plant medicines that are having a lot of success as well. But at least, you know, therapy and sadly a lot of meds are thrown at them too. But someone is at least there to help. Someone is trying to help. Why has there been so much resistance in the first responder professions, even though it's apples to apples pretty much with our military men and women, that when you do and see the kind of things that we do in uniform, more often than not, there will be an impact on the mental health of our people?
This is my opinion only, but I think there's a skepticism as a rule among legislators that you can somehow fake a post-traumatic stress or a mental or nervous injury. Now, doctors will sit in committee and scream at them that you can't. They know how to detect whether you're feigning a post-traumatic stress injury. I handled a PTSD case in Central Florida in front of a board of trustees for a line-of-duty disability pension. I won't mention the department. And simply because the firefighter had some childhood trauma that they couldn't vote to make the decision that what my client had witnessed over his career caused his PTSD, because it was mixed somehow with, you know, a childhood divorce and he had some abuse a little bit, whatever. They couldn't pull it together, even in the face of their own IME, their board's expert that my client went to, who suggested the causation was the job, the cause was the job. They couldn't do it. And we lost that case. It was terribly unfortunate. That, together with firefighters who have military experience or who have faced any amount of childhood trauma, I think the legislature just doesn't want to acknowledge that post-traumatic stress, without enumerating all of these things, is worthy of the 66 and two-thirds that workers' compensation pays. It's tragic. There's this idea that the insurance lobby, League of Cities, Association of Counties, they get, you know, these interest groups get in the legislature's offices. They line up outside your door. And I was there for 2 years. I was immersed in it. That the league, the Association of Counties, the other insurance lobbyists, they get in there and they convince these legislators that the floodgates will open and that money's going to come pouring out of the system and cost them, you know, the insurance rates are going to go up. They convince these folks of that. At the same time, these folks who are listening and vote in their favor are the ones whose pockets are lined when they run for re-election. So I don't want to get too in the weeds about politics, but I've done all of that. I practiced law. I was a firefighter. I was in the legislature. It all comes together. You know what I mean? It comes full circle. So that creates the difficulty in getting what should be in the law.
I feel like we've shot ourselves in the foot by the limited understanding of mental health in our profession. I think, you know, like you said, in the 80s, we weren't having this conversation. So as people say, they did the best with what they had. What should be happening in 2025, though, is people should be saying, well, you wouldn't have any firefighters if it wasn't for childhood trauma. If someone with a beautiful Disney-like upbringing is not going to raise their hand and say, I will go and see that horrific shit, I will cut people out of cars, I will go and retrieve the burnt cadavers, they're not. This is a, you know, it's a beautiful thing that some of the people that have had these really rough upbringings want to be the protector. You go to a crossroads. You know, James and Mike can either go one way and we become criminals, or we go another way and become helpers. It's pretty much, you look at the ACEs store, the Adverse Childhood Experience score, we supposedly on average have one of about 6 out of 10, and so do incarcerated men and women. So, you know, hurt people can hurt people or they can help people depending on their path. So understanding that a lot of people that are going to be good firefighters, cops, you know, prison guards, whatever, even dispatchers, especially the ones that are out in the streets, though, we are going to have some stuff. You've got some stuff. I've got some stuff. Now, the goal is to get people to understand that we need to work on that at the front door and create resilience. And therefore, those don't become buried down and then, you know, will rear their head later on, but they become strength. They become resilience. But I've said this ever since I put my first app in for Miami. It was a pre-app for Miami Beach. And I was honest about some stuff I'd done in the past and he screwed it up and threw it at me. And I was like, oh, so you got to lie to be a firefighter. And I lied through polygraphs, and again, it wasn't anything horrific, but I'd done some stuff when I was younger. Ironically, substances that are now known to heal PTSD. But we project this image that we want choir boys and girls, but that's a complete facade. And it's not, as you pointed out, usually one thing. It's death by a thousand cuts. It is the unaddressed childhood trauma and the sleep deprivation and the organizational betrayal and the things that we've seen and alcohol and blah, blah, blah. So it really just smacks of the complete lack of desire to really understand this population and put in steps so that as a young man or woman enters our profession, we're understanding at the front door the kind of human they are. We're addressing not just their physical fitness, but their mental health. And then that way, as they walk through, we've removed the barriers of entry to maintaining fitness standards, to maintaining the ability to seek counseling or whatever the other thing is. And you have a healthy workforce, which, as we talked about before we hit record, just like the 42-hour work week, that is proactive and fiscally sound. But what we do is this kind of false economy where we just pretend none of that is real. And then when they break, we make them fight for every single penny. And you have these men and women with cancer and, you know, career-ending back injuries and mental health crises that now have all this added stress to even just get the, you know, be taken care of for the, you know, the ultimate breaking from not solely the job, but the kind of person that would even enter the job in the first place.
Yeah, in that regard, the biggest disappointment coming out of this new PTSD bill, and again, I'm not trying to diminish what the FPF, Bernie Rock, all those guys up there did, because it's a step forward. The biggest disappointment to me was that the legislature, who has zero, I don't know, 400 guys up there, legislators, have zero idea what mental health in the fire service is or in the law enforcement. The end product was that you couldn't get wage loss unless you had an acute injury. You had one of those enumerated things. When in fact, I would bet a majority, a vast majority of mental health, including PTSD injuries, are cumulative. You know, I started in 82. By the time I got out in 07, there wasn't, I would never meet one of those criteria because I'm okay. But the cumulative effect of everything I saw is not addressed in that bill. So you're dealing with people making laws, and I'm not even talking about the state level. We're talking county, municipal government, all the way down to the bottom. They're just not trained in it. So our approach has to be different. And I don't think it comes in the way of educating any particular legislator about mental health. Why? Because they're only there as long as their term allows them to be. So it's all going to go over their head. They're not going to listen. So the approach has to be, instead of trying to get to Tallahassee and convincing them that they need to provide wage loss in case someone gets hurt with a mental injury, we've got to have a different approach. One of the approaches is something that you're involved, Second Alarm Project, and these other programs who educate the first responders themselves and management to some degree. I taught Hart Long at the last Second Alarm Project. And in the group were admin. There were some chiefs. There were some HR people. So I think instead of going to people who make the laws or who sit on county commissions or city commissions, it's to go the opposite way. It's to go from the ground up. You know, Ronald Reagan, who I thought was a wonderful president, he had that supply side economics. It's trickle down. You know, you give all the tax breaks to the big and it'll trickle down to the bottom. It's the same concept with what we've been doing and probably should continue to do with mental health laws, but it ain't working. It's just not working. So kudos to you, Second Alarm Project, and organizations like that who now want to get in on the ground and teach the firefighters about resources, about what to expect, about signs and symptoms that you could pick up on a colleague, get them help, make it private, make it at least as private as you can so that they will reach out. The reluctance is just, imagine the reluctance of a police officer. Imagine a guy or a gal with a family at home, 2-3 kids, who carries a gun every day to work, is really wrecked, but knows that if he goes to the police chief or the sheriff and says, I have PTSD, because the first thing is being taken from him is his gun.
Mm-hmm.
And so talk about a reluctance to come forward. I got a family to feed. I can't come forward. And I can't ask for help because they're going to take my gun and I won't have a salary and I burned all my leave and now what? So I have to deal with it. And that's the tragedy of it all. So I don't know the answer. I just don't. But the ground up approach to me is a better one.
I agree. And this is what I talk about a lot. I want to get people educated and angry.
You know, yeah, yeah.
The child labor laws didn't come from people shrugging their shoulders and doing nothing. They came from them saying, why are we putting up children up chimneys and why are they working in factories? You know, the Million Man March was a million men and women. It wasn't like Steve and James, you know, just, you know, there was so many people. So when a lot of people rise up together, things change. And this is what we were talking before I hit record. This is what is maddening to me, is even just getting our, you know, my rank, the firefighters, to go, for example, why are we working 56 hours a week? Why am I now being forced to work 80 from the leadership failures of people in government buildings that work 40 hours a week? Like getting people to just understand, look, this isn't right. And all these deaths are not right. Like you talk about law enforcement. I saw the other day, I think it was LA County Sheriff's Department have 12 suicides. Yeah, law enforcement suicides under this, the point was made under the certain sheriff, I think, that's in at the moment. So that's just one department. 12 people taking their own lives where they're trying to protect other people and stay alive in their job. And so I agree 100%. We have to really break down these walls. We have to understand that our first responders are overworked, underslept, and their ability to critically think is diminished. And, you know, get them to understand that and then realize that, as you know, I'm sure when you entered and certainly when I did, go back to when it was so competitive that you had people lining up around the buildings. No one can tell me that recruitment is how it's supposed to be now. Like where I live in Marion County, they're just scraping from everywhere they can to get people to fill seats. And within that group, that are going to be some phenomenal firefighters and are going to be some people that are going to absolute liability to their department, you know, their own health and then their ability to deliver service. So it is up to us, because I can tell you, for 8.5 years, I've thought that unions were going to step in and champion this. And I thought that chiefs, you know, I mean, I'll put it out here. Danny Alvarez had this bill put out that recommended the 42-hour work week in the state of Florida. And the Florida Fire Chiefs Association put out an email saying that they support the bill except the 42-hour work week. Well, if the men and women that stand at that podium and do their crocodile tears speech at the firefighter funeral are then opposing a work week that would actually be healthy for their men and women, to me, that underlines the level of support or lack thereof from them. The IAFF has never talked about the work week, even though now they're based in Boston, who works 42 hours a week, 24/72. So this is my point, is we've waited for the people that we've paid, people with the salaries and the bugles that should have been changing this, and they haven't. So it's up to us to million man march it ourselves. It's that simple.
Yeah, I agree with that approach. Fire chiefs, I think, are reluctant to do much of anything that's controversial. That's been my experience. Typically, they're at the top, riding it out, making some money, get a pension, and go home. You get a rare exception to that rule with a fire chief who's a guy's guy, firefighter's firefighter, who's just going to champion the cause until he or she's out. But that's a rarity. And then above them are the, you know, the commission and, you know, the county and state legislators and, you know, even in Congress in D.C. So there doesn't seem to be that success from the top down. So I applaud the concept, the idea, and anything you're doing, everything you're doing to bring it out, bring it, make people aware of it.
So you're king for a day now. You get to write the legislation on the stick with PTSD for a moment. What should it look like?
It should look like any other injury written in the statute. Chapter 440 is the Workers' Comp Act. It's a book this thick. Any injury, if you're on the clock and you hurt yourself, that's what we call an injury by accident. There's occupational disease, which is hypertension, heart disease, and tuberculosis. The mental or nervous injury provision of the statute is in Chapter 440, but it carves out the wage loss unless you have all these enumerated, unless you meet one of these enumerated criteria. You simply take the criteria out. If someone's diagnosed with post-traumatic stress, job-related, they should get wage loss and medical care. It's as simple as that. In fact, when I was up in Tallahassee lobbying for at one of the sessions for a comp bill, to me, even having been in the legislature and gone through the sausage making process of a bill, this fix was so easy, because all you had to do was strike the words physical injury out of the old mental health legislation. Let me back up just a little bit. The old law said you could get medical care, but if you had a physical injury that was the cause of the PTSD, then you could get wage loss. So my idea was just strike through the physical injury. Take the physical injury component out of the law. Now you get wage loss for a mental or nervous injury that's proven to be job-related. Now we can argue all day about whether the cause of the PTSD or the mental or nervous injury was the job, but medical doctors make that decision, as they do today in workers' comp. Every case I have that goes to trial is all based on medical testimony and expert testimony. So it would have been no different. But leave it to the legislature to bring the idea in, get a bill in the House, get a bill in the Senate, And by the time it makes through all those committees and comes to the floor of each chamber, it's chopped up to what we have now, which is ridiculous. When in fact, it was one strike through, period, one strike through. But League of Cities, Association of Counties, and the other insurance lobbyists, they wouldn't have it. They go in, do their work with the legislators, and here we are.
Well, it's crazy as well because the focus is on, you know,
money.
Yeah.
Instead of the person.
But even, you know, when you flip that around, again, this is what I used to sell the 2472, is like, if you look at the money, it's costing you so much more breaking your people. And no one wants to work for you anymore. So now you've got these vacancies, you've got people, you know, time and a half for overtime on paper, plus, you know, the trickle effect of the ill health and the divorces and everything else that is affecting. What blows me away is, why are we not focusing on, well, then we want to save money on this bill, so let's put the bill exactly how you just said, but let's look at how can we stop so many people getting mental health issues? What are we doing? You know, there's a beautiful Desmond Tutu quote that I've posted recently. He said, we spend so much time pulling people out of the river, we forget to go upstream to find out why they're falling in the first place. Mm. That's exactly it. There are so many elements that we can use to absolutely minimize the number of people that get to a point of clinical PTSD where they need to leave the job and have, you know, a retirement payment. We can get other people, you know, the ongoing therapy to help kind of, you know, offset some of these issues, whether it's on the job, whether it's personal, whether it's combined with an injury or an illness, and then get them back on their feet and get them back to work again. Because one of the things that kills me with this whole retirement thing is then these people are terrified, whether it's an injury, whether it's, you know, especially an injury like a back injury, is now you have to stay disabled too. There's no like, let's work on getting you well. There's like, oh, there's going to be a guy in the bushes with a camera and they're trying to catch me out. So the whole way everything is set up is to, if you even get that retirement, right, well, don't you dare get better or the money's going to stop. So why don't we focus on the things that contribute to the cancers and the PTSD and all these other things as well, so that we can save money in these bills?
Look, I welcome the thought, and your theory is right, your philosophy is right, but when you talk to people who will make these decisions, those are the folks who are beholden to special interest, and it's just too powerful. And it, again, I'm 61 now. I was a union guy my whole life and tried to champion good things, and it's a struggle. And I look back at any advancement, and I find it disappointing. We've made some steps, but geez. But I do think, I really do think that if progress is to be made at a quicker pace or a more comprehensive improvements to things that we've been talking about, it's got to come from the bottom up. And we have to educate the masses rather than the few. In other words, fend for ourselves, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm teaching these kids in these classes about signs and symptoms. What can you do? How can you help? Get them to these people. Get them to those people. Get them help early. All of these things. Because absent that, you think the suicide rate is crazy now. I mean, imagine a generation from now if we don't continue to do, I'm not including myself, I'm including you, do what you do, it's going to be, you know, exponentially worse.
Mm-hmm. I think this is why I've made the point about recruitment or the lack thereof. It's like, don't act like it's plateaued. The line is still nosediving, you know, it's getting worse and worse. And there are going to be, you know, departments that one day are going to have to tell their people, hey, we don't have a fire department anymore. Yeah. I just saw one, where was it? I forget now. I think it was in California. Yeah, it was Kings County. Well, not Kings County, one of the cities within, are about to go back to volunteer.
Oh, wow.
In 2025.
Jeez.
You know, in Central California, you know, fire department. So this is the issue, is it is getting worse and worse and worse. But, you know, just to beat the drum that I, you know, beat all the time, flog that poor dead horse. If we're talking about mental health, sleep deprivation is directly related to that. If we're talking about cancer, sleep deprivation is a carcinogen. And we're talking about the heart and lung bill, which we'll get to. Sleep deprivation is directly related to weight gain and all things disease. So if you want to do one thing to make a massive impact on all these, invest in your people and create a D shift, that will get young people wanting to do this job again.
But that's a vision. I'm not being silly. That's a vision that you can't convince someone who's got a limited time in office, whether it's a fire chief or a politician, that that's what he or she should be doing. They want to know about the here and the now. They want to fix now. And if it doesn't fix it now, they don't want to hear about it. Or they listen, but they don't act.
Mm-hmm.
You have a vision. And the people who make decisions about how to implement those things are not the ones who want to hear that vision. They want to hear what's going to happen in the next year. And that's the problem. That's the disconnect.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because you listen to City of Gainesville.
Yeah.
They went to the 2472 in September. Yeah. And not all ranks, but at the firefighter level, they are fully staffed now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they've got four, you know.
You're right. These are case studies that need to be preached at every commission meeting in the state of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
But they don't, I mean, like I said, I presented with three departments that had gone to it at the Florida Fire Chiefs conference.
Okay.
And then their response a few months later is that email.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I agree with you completely.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some phenomenal chiefs, and I want to, you know, kudos to anyone who has the guts or union leaders that have forced this. But
big change ruffles feathers.
Mm-hmm.
So you going to the Fire Chiefs Association is I applaud you for that. But you could not have walked out of there thinking they're going to champion what I just suggested.
Oh, no. I looked at the faces. And I heard some of the comments. But
right. Because that ruffles feathers. Imagine them going back to the city manager or the county commission and saying, here's a new idea. It's going to cost us five now. It's going to save us 20 in 10 years. They don't want to hear it because that 20-year savings is they want to know how to – we don't have the budget for that. No. Maybe next year. It's kick the can down the road, that silly cliche, but that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
Absolutely. All right, well, we talked about PTSD. Let's do the same thing. Let's go back to the 80s. Talk to me about cancer now.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know the data and the stats about cancer diagnosis back when I was on the job, but when it became important enough for the locals to get involved, the unions, the state organizations, they did a lot of great work. The end product in 2018 or 2019 when this bill was signed into law is the first cancer legislation for the state of Florida affecting firefighters. And I did a little bit of consulting with the FPF. It was a real struggle, James, simply because we didn't want it to be part of the Workers' Comp Act. And that's kind of a misnomer when people call me who diagnosed and, you know, should I file it under Workers' Comp? Well, you can't. And there's good reason for that. In my opinion only, I think there's good reason for that. If I'm diagnosed with cancer, like my sister was at age 18, I wanted to go to the best hospital, best doctors. If I got to go to Duke or Emory or NIH, that's where I want to go to treat my cancer. I don't want to be diagnosed with cancer in the state of Florida as a firefighter and go to a workers' comp oncologist. So that together with the insurance lobby saying the rates are going to skyrocket because of the increased number of cancers in firefighting, the end product were 21 different types of cancers. It is not a workers' comp injury or accident. And there are multiple criteria that you must meet in order to have a claim for cancer. First, it has to be one of those enumerated cancers. Secondly, you have to be on that department for five consecutive years prior to diagnosis. You can't have used tobacco products, any tobacco products, for that previous five consecutive years. You can't be in a different profession that has a higher incidence of the type of cancer you're claiming. And the only example I can probably give you there as a footnote is, let's say it's a melanoma, a skin cancer. Invasive skin cancers and melanomas are covered under the presumption. If you were a lifeguard on your 2 days off for the last 10 years, I think you'd have, I think the city or the county would have difficulty in going ahead and approving that because of that part-time job with a higher incidence of skin cancers. I don't know that, but that's an example I would give that would fit that criteria of being in another profession over the previous 5 years that
had a higher incidence of the cancer that you're alleging.
And I lifeguarded on my days off, by the way. So
did you
I
really?
Would have been screwed for a short time.
Yeah, for that type of cancer anyway. And so what it provides is that you must have the department-sponsored health program, because that's where the cancer treatment would come. And the positive thing about that is under your group health policy, you get to choose your doctors. So that's the upside. You have to have the department-sponsored health plan, and any out-of-pockets, co-pays, or the like would be reimbursed by the department. Also, the department would give a $25,000 lump sum stipend. Now, some people get a little bit confused about, well, what's that for? Just throw me a check for $25,000. The idea behind that, the legislative intent, as we say, was that if I'm a firefighter and I get diagnosed with an enumerated cancer and I meet all the other criteria and I want to go to Duke for care or Emory for care or NIH for care, let's say I'm up there 8-10 weeks of chemo, I want to be able to have my family with me. So the idea behind that money was so that you could bring your family with you for lodging and meals and things like that. It again, like the PTSD bill, it's good, it's better. But the FPF, Rocco and Bernie, those guys did a yeoman's job. It could be better. You know what I mean? It could be less restrictive. It could include additional cancers that have been proven in the fire service to have a higher incident.
Is breast cancer in that?
It is. Yeah. Okay. Let me double check just for sure. Yes. Yes.
Okay. Brilliant. And ovarian as well, I see.
Yeah.
Excellent. So one of the things that I've heard about cancer presumptions specifically in states that have the presumptive law is horror story after horror story of firefighters being fought, and even people in the insurance side being heard to say, we just fight them until they die. Talk to me about the insidious, nasty side of the opposition to actually follow through with some of these presumption laws.
I've been litigating heart presumption cases since I started in 07. And those are hotly litigated. Those cases are denied routinely. And that's why I do what I do. The cancer cases, when I get calls, I tell my clients or potential clients of all the criteria, assuming they meet them and they are entitled to the benefits that the law provides. 9 times out of 10, again, in my experience only, the department provides the benefit. I've had 2 cases where the department has, as we say, fought or defended against providing the benefit. And I don't go into the circuit court with these cases. So I tell, in these two cases where they were denied, I told them, this is what I'll do. I'll pick up the phone or I'll write a letter. Let's try to talk about this. Let's see if we can't get them to come around. So I get medical records, and on both occasions they tendered the $25,000 and provided the benefit simply by talking to the folks, because the same defense lawyers for any particular municipality who's going to fight me on a heart-lung case are going to be the ones that are assigning here. And I have a good relationship with most defense lawyers, so I pick up the phone. I go, hey, Joe Smith got a melanoma. Why are you guys denying this? Do you really want to fight this? You really want to go and fight this? This guy's going to call the press. It's just so silly. Well, you know, and some silly argument about how they're going to defend the case. And then, you know, a few days later, they're like, Mike, we got it. We're going to pick it up. So I've not had an experience like you suggested where they fight them until they die. They fight the heart claims. Trust me, I'm in the arena every day with those types of claims. But I've not had too much pushback on these.
I think it was the Carolinas specifically I'd heard that kind of horror story from.
Every state law, cancer laws are state specific, so I don't know what the criteria are in any particular state. I'm only licensed in Florida, so I can't speak to that. But it doesn't surprise me. In the end, it's an insurance dispute.
So what is different about the heart and lung bill, and why do you have such a harder time, you know, making those go through?
Yeah, good question. And I won't take a long time. Back in 1965, the legislature in Florida thought at the time firefighters were exposed to everything that we were exposed to, and thus they suggested, I don't know if it was epidemiologically proven, but they suggested that heart disease and hypertension and tuberculosis should be presumed to be job related just because of what we're exposed to. So fast forward however many years, there are certain criteria to be covered under the heart lung presumption, as it's loosely dubbed. You have to be full-time firefighter or cop or corrections officer. In 2000, corrections and police officers were brought into the fold. It used to be just firefighters. So today, it's those three class, protected class members. You have to have a form of heart disease, electrical form, plumbing, whatever it is. Typically, it's a stent or an arrhythmia or something like that. You have to have a pre-employment physical at the time you were hired that failed to evidence anything that's claimed. And then you had to have a disabling event. The disabling event triggers you. So I'll give you a quick example. If you go to the hospital with chest pain, they send you to the cath lab, you go up, you have a stent placed. During that period, you're disabled from performing the essential functions of your job as a firefighter. That triggers the case at all. You could go 30 years on the job and have, you know, your coronary artery stenosed to 70%, never have a disabling event. The day you retire, have a massive MI and not be covered. Mm-hmm. So you have to be employed. You have to meet those criteria. And then it's not an automatic. It's a presumption. So the burden shifts to the carrier, the insurance company, the employer, to prove that something else caused that heart disease. And that's terribly difficult. So they deny it on any grounds. And what has incensed me, James, since I started doing this, when I got my law license, I had two tracks I could take, one of two, either the traditional grievance arbitration route, union side labor, negotiating contracts, handling arbitrations, or the heart lung presumption. I immersed myself in this stuff and I found it the most fascinating area of the law. So it's what I do. I also travel and teach, and I teach for one reason, because the insurance carriers don't tell you about the law. They don't tell you your entitlement. They don't tell you about impairment benefits. They don't tell you about anything nuanced in the law. That makes me crazy. What they do is they know that there's 35,000 unassuming firefighters out there and twice as many cops and corrections officers. They know nothing about this law. And so if they get 10 claims, an adjuster, they send out 10 denials written in legalese. So these guys look at it and go, oh, I guess for all these reasons, I don't qualify. Eight of those guys are going away.
This is going to give up.
Two will call somebody like me or someone else. That makes me nuts. So my part of my frustration is that not only am I going to litigate these cases and just take them in and beat them up, I'm going to travel the state and I'm going to teach this stuff to firefighters and cops. And that's what I do, you know, a few times a year, conferences and things like that. Like next week, I'll see you at the FPF, I'm sure.
Yes.
Yeah. Good. Yeah.
Speaking of a little side story, I posted that I would be there. And then I got a phone call saying I wasn't allowed to use their logo when I was telling everyone I was going to speak at their conference.
And what, which logo? The FPF?
The FPF's logo. And I was like, you understand how crazy that sounds, right? That I'm traveling all this way to speak about this thing for free down in West Palm, and I can't use your Maltese cross with FPF written on it. So this, you know, there to me, therein lies the problem. I'm like, if that's your focus, then maybe you need to take a step back and reevaluate that, because that's insane. I'm literally coming to your conference. This is,
you know,
advertising for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, man. I love the FPF. I love Bernie and Rocco and all those guys. I suspect that was a resolution at some conference about using and expose, you know, whatever. And it was voted on by the masses, and that's just the rule. I know Wayne Bernowska, Bernie, you know him, Rocco Salvatore. These guys would have no problem with that. I mean, mm-hmm. That's just my opinion.
Yeah.
I use the international logo on my post because all the firefighters that I represent are members of the international. And I'm a dues-paying retiree. I've never gotten any flack for that, but I'm surprised by that.
Yeah, it was a good example of the ridiculousness of red tape. I think that's all I'm highlighting that.
Yeah, sure.
All right. Well, then you talked about an incentive, an initiative that you have to help firefighters. So let's unpack that a little bit.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. I've probably said this three times since I got on the mic. I'm an old guy now. I'm 61 years old, right? But I feel like I'm 30. And I sat back, I don't know, a few months ago, and I thought, you know, I think I'm doing good work. People tell me I'm doing good work. I'm helping a lot of people. And it's Florida specific, right? I'm licensed to practice in Florida. But I'm partnered with this huge law firm, the biggest one, everyone knows about it. And we have offices in every state in the nation. So it struck me, how can I leave a legacy of impacting people beyond the state of Florida? Firefighters, those are my people, right? And I wondered, I can't be so limited to Florida and at the same time be tied to this huge firm that have offices in every state in the nation. How can I touch firefighters who will trust me to put them in the right hands if they need help? And so it's still in that theory stage, this idea, but I'm in the process now of developing an app where people can, I can travel the country and talk to the folks I know in different states who are with the international and have an app that their members can have on their phone. And if they get hurt, touch it, make it as easy as possible. I mean, almost just crazy easy. It comes to me, I get them the help they need within, you know, hours. Again, it's just an idea, but I think the best way to do it, because I've spoken to the 12th DVP of the International, Walt Dix, you probably know Walt, and some other district vice presidents around the country, and they love the idea, and they want to help if they can. So I told you before, I think I got another 10 or 15 years, but you know, in the meantime, I want to help people beyond Florida, firefighters. And if I can do it in a way that makes it easy for them and they can get help with great lawyers. I know some of the best lawyers around. They're with this firm. There's people knocking this firm down to get in, and John only hires the best. So if they can trust me to put them in the best hands, that's a way that I can continue to provide help.
How, if any, you know, if there's any way at all, how can people listening help with this movement?
You know, that's a good question. I think I'm going to have to visit state conferences, go to the international every 2 years, go to the Redmond Symposium, go to these things and shake hands with folks. I know a smattering of folks that are with some big, big locals. I know Nate Bailey in Atlanta and some few other states out west who are high on the idea. I think I just have to get around and meet these people, give them information about the app so that they can disseminate it to their folks and convince them that I don't care where they are in the country, I can put them in the hands of the best people to help them. I think the app will be out in the next month or so. I'm using actually the same folks that developed the Second Alarm Project.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. I've been in touch with those guys. So they're excited, and we'll put something together, and I'll let you know.
Yeah, please do. Yeah. Actually got Kelly O'Dare coming on, I think, next week.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and then, which is interesting, she's got her, and then there's a gentleman, Keith, from FSU, are studying Gainesville and Destin. They okay. both went to 2472 already. So they've got baseline testing, and we're going to be seeing, you know, the physiological results. Now, again, you don't have to be genius to understand that, of course, it's going to be better.
Yep.
But the people that say they want to see the data, all right, there's your data.
Now you know, I was going to pose that question to you. Those departments who have gone, and the trend is up, thank God, including Destin and Gainesville and these other folks, I just say that collectively because I'm in the fire service background. Are we tracking any difference between the old schedule and the new schedule so that we can help other departments?
I think that's what's happening with FSU. I mean, if you got Hugh Bruder and out at Boynton Beach, I'm sure they can now, it's been about 2 years, I'm sure they can start looking at some of the financial side as well. But I mean, it's just, you know, really, if you put it on paper, I mean, it's, you know.
So the trend obviously would be down in terms of people affected by mental health with
everything.
Better schedules. Yeah, sleep and everything.
Even relationships. I mean, you know, mom and dad are going to be home when they're supposed to be home. You know, so the mandatory overtime all but goes away unless there's a hurricane or a COVID or something.
Yeah.
My friend Matt from Gainesville, I hit him up. I was like, so what do you think? He said, James, I would never go back to the old schedule. Wow. And yet I have people that don't understand this that go, oh, I want to do the 48-96. It's like, you just go and listen to the people that have gone to this, you know, and then what they did to fight for it and where the money was already and all this stuff. And I won't go down that rabbit hole, but yeah, it's really brilliant to hear. And then there's a Florida department that I'm super excited for in our area that is hopefully going to go very soon. There's a Texas department that's about to go. So it's happening. So every single department, you start chipping away at that, you know, facade of it will never happen. Like you said, you know, the fiscal year chief or union leader or whoever it is, that's the barrier to entry. And people are like, well, wait a second. If Pasco could go to it, if Palm Beach could go to it, why can't we go to it? So that's what I'm hoping will happen next. And again, that all filters into all the things we've discussed today.
Yeah. Is there any common denominator about how those particular departments became good with the idea? How they were impacted? Was it just they had the right politics at the commission level?
Was relationships.
Yeah.
That was it. Sure. If you don't have this head knocking. I mean, the perfect example, Orange County and Orlando. When I was there, they didn't play well together.
Yeah.
Ocala and Marion County don't play well together. And that just disgusts me.
Yeah.
Like, you're a bunch of grown-ups that are supposed to be serving your community, and you don't, you know, one of you thinks that you're better than the other, like, for the love of God. But the Pascos and, you know, the Boyntons and all these other places that have made it happen, you know, some of them, the one that's going to happen soon, I believe it was the city that came to the fire department and said, what about this? Which is amazing. But having that relationship and these unions and chiefs and admins and, you know, cities and counties all talking in a room and saying, well, they're listening, and then going, well, that actually makes a lot of sense. That's the difference. It's having the humility, dropping the egos.
Of course,
And then looking at the money too. If you weren't going to save money, then this would be a hard sell. But realizing how you're struggling to recruit and how you're bleeding overtime, which is killing your people. This is, you know, it's not the magic bullet, but my God, it's a pretty damn powerful one.
It's about getting them to listen. Just come in the room and listen. Just have a discussion. And that could be said for national politics, but I won't bore you with that. I mean, that the middle of politics has evaporated. Everybody's on their, you know, in their corner. It's awful.
I honestly think there's going to be a revolution of the middle. Yeah. I really do.
I hope.
Thinking the other day, you know, if you've ever done pottery and the spinning wheel,
wheel, yeah.
If the clay is off kilter, it just spins and flies into the, I feel like that's what's happening with the extremism now. I think we're watching the wheels just come off, and the people in the middle, I think they're going to rise up. And I truly believe that there's going to be a kind of community of kindness, compassion,
I hope.
The normal people in the middle again.
From your mouth to God's ears.
One more thing
before
we close out, because it kind of ties everything in together. Along with my vision, which is already happening, this revolution of 24/72, I think that there needs to then be a fitness standard put in. Now, you're sitting across from me at 61 years old. One of the places that you find peace is the gym. What is your impression of fitness standards in the fire service? Of course, we both know that would positively impact the heart and lung bill, the cancer bill, the mental health bill. But as, you know, someone who rose through the ranks and now has been fighting for the first responders and seeing the downstream effects of ill health, talk to me about the need or if you think that there shouldn't be of fitness standards at the front door continue through to when we retire.
I think the masses are about 50-50, James. And I was the fitness instructor in Longwood. I mean, it's such a silly moniker, but that's what it was. They said, oh, Mike Clellan, you like to work out, so you know you're gonna run these guys through a monthly test. And I looked to the military to get I didn't want to be too, you know, iron-fisted, but we put together something. Everybody bought in. There was a little bit of a cardio involved. There was some strength testing. There was some mobility and stress stretching and things like that. And everybody bought in. There were always resistors. There always will be. My take on it now, looking at 2025, is you see the Jason Wheats of the world. These guys are amazing, and they're relentless and just. I applaud them. They're just doing yeoman's work. I don't know. I've been out of the service for so long. I don't know on the inside what that ratio is like, the resistors to those who buy in. The key, I think, is to get a Jason Wheat in front of you and just say, look, here's the way it should be, and ease into it. And then as it's shown to be not so oppressive, and I'm thinking in the mind of a resistor, that eventually you can get some buy-in. Or you make it mandatory. But then you get the guys negotiating at the table, the same 50% that are saying, F you, I'm not doing that. I'm coming to work, doing my job, I'm going home. You prove to me I'm not capable. I pass the fit for duty every year or every 2 years. So then now the union guy's conflicted about putting something in the contract that requires certain amount of time to do X, Y, and Z. I don't know how you get everybody to buy in, but it was hot back in the 80s and 90s to get everybody to buy in, and I'm sure it's the same now. But I do, looking from the outside, I see that it's a bigger, I think more people are buying in. I mean, look at First Response Training Group with Jay. Those guys are like militaristic. I mean, I see them training just, this is fire standards. And these guys are fit, you know? Everything you said makes sense in terms of the consequences of not being fit. But getting someone to remain in good physical and mental health is a completely different story. Why? Because these guys are going home for 2 or 3 days and they're living their lives the way they want to live them. My brother Steve, 30-year guy, not in the best of shape, lives like Ernest Hemingway. That school of thought is, you know, fuck it. I'm living life the way I want to live my life. I have one life, and I'm still able to do that job. He did it for 30 years. He was on Tower One.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, you know, my school of thought is, dude, you're 62, 63. You got to, you know, not live like Hemingway and get in shape and sleep well and all of these things. I don't know how to convince the majority.
What's interesting, and I've said this so many times on here, is if you think about the front door of the Florida Fire Service, everything is set up to, you know, for a bar to be maintained. We literally call our certification minimum standards. Mm. That's it. It's labeled. This is the shittest you should ever be the rest of your career. And so we have the opportunity to be like, oh, we just need you to do what you could do in the academy. Oh, no, that's not fair. What do you mean it's not fair? It's literally the thing that you had to meet to get the piece of paper that allows you to do this. And what's really interesting profession that I contrast, which is one of the other jobs that I did, even though I was never working on the ocean, but you listen to the ocean lifeguards, they requalify. I just had a Hawaii one every 6 months, this one. And the one I did, we did swim tests all the time, but I think it was every year or 2 years we requal. But regardless, say it's 2 years, worst case. If James Gearing can't do the swim tests and the toes and the dummy retrievals, then I'm not a lifeguard anymore. And that's where I think the bar should be held. It's like, you cannot complain that a fitness test is unfair when you knew exactly what to expect when you went through the fire academy. I don't remember any lazy boys and, you know, Jerry Springer marathon sessions in the fire academy. But like you said, don't go extreme and be like, you got to do a 500-pound deadlift and a 2-meter vertical leap. And of course, but you know, whether it's Rick Seagrass, you know, fire sled version of the CPAT, CPAT, there's nothing unfair about a CPAT. And I'm sorry, but anyone in the fire service should be able to do a CPAT in less than 10 minutes and 19 seconds. I did it at 47 years old, a few years ago, to get ready for Gainesville when I thought the money was going to run out for the podcast, and it was 7:20. So that's 3 minutes over an old guy that you've got to get it done. Yeah, so I don't want to hear about, it's not fair. So this is, I think, where we've got to really, you know, grow a set is at the front door, make it mandatory. And then for all our men and women, of course, don't just implement it and say by tomorrow, you've got to be able to meet the standard. There's got to be an on-ramp session. But at what point do you draw a line in the sand and go, look, you either can or you can't. If a child dies because you tapped out on the third floor, and we're worried about hurting your feelings, then you're in the wrong job. It's that simple. So I think we've really got to kind of be a little courageous in the fitness standard conversation.
Agreed. Too. It's the approach too. You don't want to scare these guys into thinking, you know, who are you? Especially if you're in a department of, you know, 150 guys and 40 of them are on their way out in 2 years. You know, they're just going to sit back and say, here you go, whatever, whatever. It's going to, you know, be like water off a duck's back. Convincing the younger generation, I think, is key. When I went and taught Heart Lung at First Response, just a full classroom of kids. And I think if we can get them young, like Jason and those guys are doing out there, more broadly. And I think fitness is bigger now. I think the younger generation are conscious of fitness.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my take.
People have told me that the fit firefighters, the fit military recruits are fitter than they've ever been. Now, we've got a large portion that aren't, but of the people that step up and toe the line, they're seeing a lot of the fit ones are in incredible shape, which is amazing.
Yeah, and that's good news. And then us old folks will fall off the back end, and then maybe it'll be a generational thing, and maybe firefighters just as a rule will become more fit just because of society. You know, I mean, social media and stuff, everybody's on there with, I mean, my son, all his friends are all fit and in the gym and taking pictures of themselves, and it's silly. But if those are the generation, if that's the generation coming through to go into the fire service, then that's a good thing because now they're more conscious of how healthy they are.
Absolutely. I think with the argument with the people deeper into their career is like, look, when you're done, don't you want to be in the best shape so that you can prolong your retirement? Like on average, we die, it seems to be a nationally accepted standard of 5 years. And no one's done a study yet, but all over the country, people say the same thing. So it's obviously an observational, you know, number. So even though you got 2 years left, you may not get to the point of, you know, your 30-year-old self, but let's get you back to where your body composition is better and your cardiovascular system is better and your mental health is better before you make, as we said, that jarring transition and you leave your tribe and now you're, you know, in Kentucky somewhere and questioning what you're going to do next.
Yeah, I see these retiree groups on Facebook. You see the same ones, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I see them at their luncheons. And I tell you, I'm almost as old as that group. And I don't know. I shake my head, man. And God love them. They did their job, that, you know, and they're living their lives with their families. But it boggles my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean.
But it's that culture.
And, yeah.
You know, 30 years from now, what will that group look like? Hopefully,
right.
You know. They'll be transitioning to another career and they'll still be in great shape and their mental health will be intact. So this is the thing. Like, and I've said this many times. We stand on the shoulders of giants, like your generation and prior to that, you know, whether it's SCBAs or, you know, EZIOs or whatever it is. There's so many pioneers on the operational side. But most of those innovations have already happened. There's only so many ways you can reimagine a Halligan or a nozzle
or
a ladder. Where we can be pioneers now is to change the human and not only address the ill health, but actually then transition into performance. How can that firefighter make it up that set of stairs and still have a lower heart rate? And, you know, their breath work has now got them into
consuming less of the bottle. Mm-hmm, yeah.
Now they're in an ability to really focus. So this is, to me, you know, what we can do for the next generation is not invent a new mask or air pack, but address all the things from the work week to the fitness standards to the mental health outlets so that this next generation can maintain a health in a way that we've never seen in our profession before.
Yeah.
So with that being said, then, before we close out, is there anything else you want to say as we depart?
No, look, I just, if someone needs help, use my cell phone. A lot of people call the firm the big number, and by the time it gets to me, it's a little maddening. But I'll go back to that night in property class. I want people to be able to get a hold of me. So my cell is 407-375-8887. You can call me around the clock. And beautiful. I appreciate you having me back.